Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
As the 2014 session of the Virginia General Assembly convenes in Richmond, there are calls from both sides of the aisle to improve the state's mental health care system. I'm Maylily Lee. Thanks for joining us today. We're discussing some of those proposed improvements and discussing why they are so urgently needed. The shortfalls in the mental health care system came into sharp focus last November when State Senator Cree Deeds was stabbed multiple times by his 24-year-old son, Gus, who then committed suicide. The attack happened the morning after Gus was released from an emergency custody order. Local mental health officials said he was not admitted to a psychiatric facility because there were no beds available in what they termed a wide area of Virginia. The Washington Post reports there were indeed beds available at three hospitals in the area, but those facilities were never contacted. Beyond that confusion, there's bipartisan agreement that the state needs better mental health care. Senator Deeds recovered from the attack and is back to work at the General Assembly, this time with mental health care reform on the top of his agenda. It's also a top priority for outgoing Governor Bob McDonnell, something he made clear in his final State of the Commonwealth address.
In this biennial budget, I'm also recommending to you an additional $38 million for critical mental health services, like crisis prevention and intervention, community-based mental health programs, and bed space capacity. Working with Governor-elect McAuliffe, we've also put in place an executive order to study in detail our mental health system and make more recommendations to you soon. Mental health challenges affect so many Virginia families. We all perhaps have a story to tell. I believe we have to do all we can to provide immediate help to those in need and comfort to those who hurt.
Now joining us in our Richmond studio to discuss the problems and possible solutions to the state's mental health care system is Mira Signer, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Virginia. And later we'll hear from Bonnie Neighbor of Vocal, another advocacy group. We also welcome Delegate Joseph Yost, who represents the 12th House District in the General Assembly and who has introduced legislation to improve the system. Delegate Yost is also a member of the Governor's Task Force on Improving Mental Health Services and Crisis Response, which just met for the first time earlier this week. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Hi, Delegate Yost. Are you loud and clear on the other line as well?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here.
Since you're in the hot seat, Delegate Yost, I'd like to turn to you for an update on what is going on this week. What updates can you bring us from the task force?
Well, I think, you know, we met for our first time on Tuesday from 1 to 4, and it was mainly an organizational meeting, setting up the work groups and everything that's going to take place. We did hear and take in a lot of information from the Department of Behavioral Health, from law enforcement, from our hospitals, on some of the things and things that they recommend and need that they see as we are moving forward. There has been multiple bills that have been introduced relating to mental health reform, some of which I am carrying. And I imagine that it will continue to be a hot topic, not only this session, but in the coming sessions as well.
Okay. We had an article that we were just looking at earlier from Charlottesville Weekly, and it talks about some of the misses and the hits with respect to the governor's budget proposals. One of the key sources of conversation seems to be that the governor's proposal wants to increase beds in hospitals, and many advocates feel that sort of misses the mark.
Well, you know, I think when we look at it, I think the governor's proposal is a good start. There's other things that I would like to see in the area of prevention and some budget amendments that I'm going to be introducing later today along those lines. You know, I have been actively involved in crisis intervention training for many years now, and to see additional monies for those services, I think, is a great step in the right direction.
And here's a quote from that article. McDonald's proposed budget would provide funding to expand several of the programs available throughout the state, and it talks about the breakdown of that budget. But a larger portion of the money would go toward expanding capacity at hospitals, something that people say shouldn't be the state's top priority. Mira, do you want to address that?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because Virginia, over many, many years, really has sort of struggled to get this balance, an appropriate balance between care that is provided in hospital settings versus care that is provided in the community. And the push over the past 10, 15, 20 years has really turned towards a community-based system of care. And that follows kind of a shift in philosophy about the treatment and the understanding of mental illness, as well as some legal cases at the Supreme Court, as well as the Americans with Disabilities Act in the late 1990s. But it's been a struggle. It's really been a struggle. Virginia tends to fund hospital-based care, inpatient-based care, more so than it does services in the community. We did see that reflected in the governor's budget, and it'll be interesting as, you know, the conversation goes forward, how that might get kind of tweaked and adjusted based on, you know, the input from the public and advocates and so forth.
Mira just used the word conversation, and I'd like to toss this both to you, Delegate, and to you, Mira. We look at 2008, the Virginia Tech tragedy, and then we fast forward to 2012, the Sandy Hook tragedy, and more recently, the Creed Deed shooting. And it seems that with each of these major events, a bill is introduced. The General Assembly is actualized into creating new legislation. It feels very reactive. How do you deal with that, Delegate Yost, when it should be an ongoing conversation?
You know, I think it definitely should be an ongoing conversation, and that's something that I've tried to push, you know, really hard in my first term for the past 2 years. You know, this has been something that I've brought to the legislature, and probably only one of maybe less than four or five individuals at the most that has experience and some in-depth knowledge and detail of the mental health system. And so having that sort of helps me out a lot. But, you know, I think you are right. There is this ultimate reaction whenever something like this goes down and to maybe possibly put a Band-Aid on it. You know, I think if you look back over the time since April 16th in Blacksburg, there were a lot of changes and a lot of increased funding that came down the pike. But if you look at the budgets has it's changed because of the recession and everything, most of the new money that was put in the system, unfortunately, has disappeared over the last 5 or 6 years. So this $38 million is really going to backfill a lot of what we've lost since the recession started.
And just to kind of echo that, it is frustrating. It's frustrating to people who have tried to get access to services and families who have tried to do that as well. You know, our general feeling is that the mental health system, while there have been improvements, especially since 2007, that we're still, by and large, making up for a lot of deficits for a system that really was pretty neglected for a number of years and as a result has become fragmented and difficult to access and difficult to navigate. And, you know, we really feel that there are long-term sustainable solutions that are needed and you know, and not necessarily kind of knee-jerk type reactions or kind of quick fixes here and there. So it is frustrating, you know, especially to people in the community who have been working on trying to make improvements. And, you know, I think often we feel like we sort of constantly are shouting it from the rooftops. But, you know, the reality is that there are many competing priorities. It's difficult, especially when you have a legislature that meets only for 45 or 60 days out of the year. And they certainly have a lot on their plates, you know, to really make sure that an issue like mental health comes to the forefront. Unfortunately, it does sometimes take a tragedy, and you know, we do wish that it was different. And again, it'll be interesting to see, you know, does the conversation change? Will there be a little bit of a shift? You know, certainly there seem to be more champions within the legislature and the policymaking system than in recent years. And, you know, that has to do, I think, in large part with just growing awareness of the problems. You know, more people, Governor McDonnell in his State of the Nation or State of the State speech talked about how we have to tell our stories, you know, more people telling their stories. You know, those are things that are helping. But certainly it is frustrating when we kind of rely on these tragedies to create action.
We have two callers on the line, both with Region 10, which is one of 40 community service boards in Virginia serving Charlottesville, Albemarle, Fluvanna, Nelson, Louisa, and Greene counties. It's a community mental health center providing comprehensive services. And we have on the line Molly Yates and Donna Dean. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Were you among those who were heartened to see the governor's budget and the amounts of money that would be devoted to improving mental health care in Virginia?
Well, I think it's encouraging that there's momentum and that there's some energy being put forward, and it looks like there's the potential for a real productive conversation.
And this one is Donna or Molly?
This is Molly. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Great.
I'm with emergency services.
Okay. Continue.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, again, there's a real potential for just real productive, healthy conversation. I mean, the problem is that it's a real multifaceted issue and real multifaceted problem. And we're glad that they're putting forth the money. It does, it's a real question about where it should be targeted, and that's what they're working on. And it's also, there's 40 CSBs, and so how it's distributed is a big concern, a big question. But it's very encouraging that there's progress being made. And again, it feels like this conversation has needed to happen in a thorough, healthy way for a long time, and that there is the potential for that now.
Donna, your thoughts?
Well, as the director of the PACT team for Region 10 and someone who speaks to other PACT team leaders around the state, it does make me hope that those kind of community-based services will be expanded, because the PACT programs are really effective at reducing the need for hospitalization.
Okay. And I appreciate
hospitalization is needed. I think the resources should be there for that as well. But these kind of programs can help prevent the need.
And before we let either of you go, Donna or Molly, do you have any questions or comments for Delegate Yost?
I don't think I have any specific questions. But again, we're so happy that people are really putting their heads together and really getting the issues out there on the forefront, and we appreciate his involvement.
Well, thank you. Thank you all for what you do.
Thank you so much, both of you, for calling in today. And I want to talk a little bit, Delegate Yost, about what was brought out during the campaign session, and that is Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your thought on the role that Medicaid expansion can play in helping to fund mental health services in Virginia?
Well, you know, I have always sort of leaned towards the affirmative on Medicaid expansion. You know, it's a very tough thing to deal with in Virginia. We have a balanced budget, so we can't spend, you know, any more money than we take in. You know, I think it would be very beneficial for the mental health system, but also for rural areas as well, which is not part of what we're talking about. But, you know, I think, you know, as we move forward, you know, if we do lean, and Virginia does, to decide to expand Medicaid, I think it's important that, you know, we do have the necessary reforms in place, because, I mean, it can be costly down the road. Medicaid is quickly growing in our state budget. You know, over the last quarter of a century, it's went from being, you know, right at 5% to almost 25% now, and is growing every year. But it does provide a vital service for individuals who could not get insurance otherwise. And I think if, you know, a lot of individuals with mental illness or their family members had access to these services, you know, we wouldn't see them cycling in and out of hospitals like we do, or even in and out of jails. You know, right now in Virginia, between 25% and 30% of our jail population is composed of individuals with serious mental illness or a mental illness. And, you know, if they had regular access to services like you and I do every day, and could go to a primary care doctor versus going to the emergency room, we would see, I think, a decrease in costs across the board.
Mira Signer.
Well, there's no doubt our organization is very strongly in support of Medicaid expansion, and there's no doubt that providing services, mental health services, in a proactive, preventive manner is going to not only have some cost savings and benefits to the Commonwealth, but will have, you know, obviously a better outcome and a healthier outcome for the person who can access not only mental health services, but also physical health services. And we know that currently, right now, just within the Community Services Board system, which those are the local mental health agencies that serve people who are low income, poor, indigent, and disabled, there are at least 20,000 people who would be eligible for Medicaid if Medicaid were expanded in Virginia. And that's something that the Commonwealth is footing the bill for already. So our feeling is, you know, let's get the services that folks really need instead of kind of just bare bones services here and there that this group of 20,000 gets, which is actually could be even a little bit more than 20,000 once the enrollment is rolled out and that sort of thing. So we really feel that it's very important. As the delegate mentioned, there are lots of folks who, you know, kind of cycle in and out of much more costly services, in part because they're delaying access to treatment because, you know, no surprise, they don't have a way to pay for it, and that can be a real burden. So we're hopeful. We're going to be working with different coalitions to really try to make an effort to get this through this session.
Give us a thumbnail, if you will. Where does Virginia rank in comparison with the other states in terms of levels of community-based services?
Sure. Well, according to the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, which is a national body that looks at those figures, Virginia ranks 37th in the nation in our funding levels of community-based services.
That's pretty low.
It's low. It's in about the lower third percentage. So that's, you know, we've got a lot of work to do to kind of climb up to the top on that. And then, you know, conversely, we rank towards the top, about number 10 in our funding of institutional hospital-based care. A lot of states have managed to flip that to provide robust, kind of very comprehensive community-based services, as one of the callers mentioned, that can lessen the need for hospital-based care so that when you need that hospital-based care for somebody, they can really access it.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Next week, Teaching College from the High Seas, how one Virginia Tech instructor broke new ground in his teaching. Stay with us. We'll be back with more of this conversation on Virginia Conversations. And welcome back. Today we're discussing the state of mental health care in Virginia and proposals to improve the system. Our guests are Delegate Joseph Yost, who represents the 12th House District in the General Assembly, Mira Signer, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Virginia, and also joining us is Bonnie Naber. She is the Executive Director of VOCAL, Virginia Organization of Consumers Asserting Leadership. Welcome, Bonnie. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, thank you. Let me tell you for a second a little bit about what VOCAL is. VOCAL is a statewide community support network, social change movement, and self-help education program created for and by people who identify as having a lived experience with mental health challenge.
And that's an interesting word you're using, a person with lived experience. The word consumer, mental health consumer, is sort of going out. And you yourself, you're a person with lived experience. Explain.
Sure. I as a young adult, started experiencing some things that didn't help me along my life journey. They were getting in my way, and sought out help, actually, and didn't receive a diagnosis for many years. But after 15 years, was diagnosed with my first of six different mental health diagnoses. And so I certainly identify as an individual experiencing mental health symptoms. Excuse me. I'm also an individual in recovery, and recovery is a new concept relatively, and maybe started talking about it in the 40s, that prior to that, we looked at mental illness as possibly a lifetime illness that got worse and worse with people's life as it went on. I was certainly told when I was diagnosed in 95 that my symptoms were going to get worse and harder to manage, and that I would be not able to take care of myself as my life went on, and I needed to set up those safety nets to take care of me. Well, that's not necessarily true. We now look at mental health recovery. People can still perhaps live with those symptoms, but can learn tools to deal with them and tools to be able to manage the symptoms and certainly live fulfilling lives, following career paths of their choice.
Often. And two of your key diagnoses were post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar disorder.
Correct. So one of my early diagnoses was bipolar disorder, and I started receiving treatment for bipolar disorder that certainly helped to manage the symptoms of that diagnosis. And I agree that I fit the criteria for that diagnosis. And the unfortunate piece is, as the symptoms were being managed, my life became more and more difficult to live. I was less able to think through things. I was less able to work. At one point was put on disability as I was being treated because I became unable to leave the house and unable to leave work. And not until I started entertaining the idea that much of this might be coming from post-traumatic stress disorder, even though I identify with the symptoms of bipolar disorder, we started looking at the treatment differently, was I able to get back on my feet.
You talk about the 70s. Do you think the system is better suited to dealing with major mental illness now than then?
In the 40s, when we first started talking about mental health recovery, people were diagnosed and put into institutions and told they'd spend the rest of their life in institutions.
What about your early years of diagnoses? I'm comparing then to now. Let's say someone is just now dealing with new diagnoses. Are they at least going to fare better than you did in those early years?
I believe so. Even though, as a society, we were talking about recovery when I was diagnosed, that's not what I was told. Recovery wasn't necessarily what was being told by providers. They weren't. The community was talking about recovery. The providers were not there yet. Now I believe people hear that word recovery, and they're given the opportunity sometimes for some services that help support their recovery. And services that help support recovery would be ones that help them flourish in employment. Employment is so important, or fulfillment and purpose is so important to people's well-being, whether they have a mental health condition or not. And often when I was first diagnosed, people were told, no, you can't work. You're too sick to work. And now they're
functioning and productive.
And now they're often told, well, work might be good for you. How can we support you in finding some valuable work?
And I want to come back to your story. Let's take this call from Byron from Charlottesville. Byron, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah. You're on the air.
Okay, thanks. Hey, listen, I worked as a senior psychologist for a major state hospital here in Virginia for 5 years, and then was a chief psychologist at one of our largest prisons. And I when listening, first of all, I appreciate all the comments that are made, and I appreciate, our representative and what he's doing. We had, at one time in this state, over 6,000 patients in Central State Hospital. And now we have less than 100 on the civil side. And so where did those patients go? Those patients went, many of them, into the prisons, as the representative indicated, and on the street. And the people have commented on the show that a lot of the money goes to community-based, but not, to the hospital, but not to community. And I saw kind of the difference there. I saw that people were turned away from the hospital and that they were discouraged from hospitalizing people. And while I believe in the least restrictive environment, there are many people out there that need corporate care. But because we have focused on on putting people in the community, we've pulled dollars away from those hospitals that could provide services to people who need them instead of putting those poor souls in prison, because they're going to seek corporate care and get it if they need it, even if it means being locked up in Greensville prison.
All right. Thank you so much for this input. Byron, I know that Mira has a response to that. Thanks for your call.
Sure.
Sure. I think the caller had excellent points, and he's right. Part of the problem and one of the outcomes of this fairly rapid deinstitutionalization process that not only Virginia but the rest of the nation went through was that services and funding that was supposed to be poured into the community simply didn't happen. It was seen as a way for states to save money. And as a result, as we've seen over time, is our jails are now serving as a de facto mental health system for many people with mental illnesses, including serious mental illnesses. And there are also issues of people who are homeless with mental illness and also substance use. So he's really right in a sense in that there are we really possibly swung a little bit too far in the other direction. However, I would say that a lot of these issues with now people in jails with mental illness and so forth, they're a symptom of really not getting the fix right. For example, there are lots of people who are currently in state hospitals who are clinically ready to be discharged. There's actually a clinically ready for discharge list, but they cannot be discharged. It's about 10% consistently of our state hospital population. They literally cannot be discharged because services in the community, such as housing, such as outreach teams, wraparound services, various supports and those kinds of things, do not exist. They do not exist. And the Inspector General has reported on this over and over again. So that creates a backup of not allowing people who need to be in hospitals to be able to be in hospitals. You've also got issues in the private sector. When state hospitals began to downsize, the expectation and the hope was that the private sector would essentially pick up the slack, and there are state general funds that help to aid in that process. Well, there's virtually not enough money to make that happen. In fact, regions run out of this specialized private hospital bed purchase money sometimes through in the middle of the year. You've also got a problem of people who are uninsured, and hospitals really don't want to carry the burden of basically eating those funds. So, okay, well, we've got to find a way to get these folks insured so that the hospitals have an incentive to pay for the person. So the caller makes good points, and I think the other point is that it's a very complex kind of interwoven issue. It's really not simply a matter of just going back to the way we did things and putting folks in hospitals. I think most of us recognize that by and large, hospitals back in the day were not comfortable, great places where most of us would want our loved ones or where most of us would want to stay ourselves. That's why this issue has to be tackled from many different points and many different aspects.
Delegate Yost?
Comment?
Yes.
Several years
ago. Oh, I'm
back,
sorry. I wanted to go to Delegate Yost before we come back to you, Byron. I just want to see if you have a point to add.
Yeah, I completely concur with what, Mira is saying. You know, in Virginia, I think if you looked back into the, mid to late 70s, we had about an average daily population of a little over 7,000, close to 8,000 people in our hospitals, and today I think it fluctuates between 16 and 1,700. I'm a believer in community-based services. Studies have consistently shown that individuals who are in the community surrounded by their family and friends, will achieve a road to recovery, more than likely. But the problem was you know, we literally, you know, shove these individuals out the door without adequate services in place. And so now they are filling up our jails and prisons. I mean, I think, like I said earlier, about 30% of our jail population, you know, consists of individuals with mental illness, unfortunately. Now, I will say conversely to that, you know, Virginia has sort of led at the forefront on trying to fix and correct that problem with our various jail diversion programs that we have across the Commonwealth, most specifically our CIT program for law enforcement, which is supposed to prevent that criminalization of individuals with mental illness.
Okay, Byron, if you can keep it tight, go ahead and make your point, and then we'll move on.
You bet. Well, you know, several years back, you know, I spoke with a previous governor on this program, and my comment was that because every governor who comes into office is immediately a lame duck, the head of mental health for the Commonwealth is immediately starting to develop programs that, if they take a long time to come to fruition, if they're comprehensive, they're going to be seen by a governor that they haven't met yet. So they're trying to please a governor that they haven't met yet, since they're appointed to that position. And I think that we need to look at allowing the people who run mental health to create comprehensive programs that last. These programs they're going to take a time. They're going to take time to make those changes.
Okay.
And I think that we need to give a little bit more support to the people who are making those decisions in the Department of Mental Health.
Okay, Byron, thank you so much for that comment. We do appreciate it. I want to move on to Elizabeth, but first you have a quick comment.
Sure. I think it's also important to remember that statistically, the National Institute of Mental Health says 1 in 4 people have a mental health condition that's diagnosable mental health condition, or 1 in 17 with a serious mental health condition, with that amount of our population and the fewer dollars going to community-based services, people often tend to seek out services and not be able to get them until they get into crisis or get into emergency, and then we see them in the jails or the hospitals. If we could provide services in the community more readily, I think we could help turn that around also.
We have a call from Elizabeth from Christiansburg. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. I'm an in-home mental health support provider, although now as of 12/1, our new title is in-home mental health skill builder. And I have two quick comments. Number one, the governor changed the rules for mental health supports in terms of when people are getting help in the community before it involves the hospital system and gets more expensive. You know, there's the CSB, there's PAC teams, but there's also, you know, private agencies that do mental health support. The governor changed the criteria required for people to receive mental health reports and made it that much harder for people to get mental health supports. The other thing on, and I'd like a comment about that, the other issue is in terms of people capturing the amount of money that liaisons in mental health support save the community overall is never captured. There was a recent study done by MIT, and what that study said was that people that are enrolled in Medicaid, that they once they become enrolled, they use the service more. What they're not looking at is the dollar value in terms of what is saved by having people in disabled people's homes, helping them use the health services appropriately. So they're not using emergency rooms, so they're not using ambulances. They're saving the community a tremendous amount of money, and nobody is capturing that number.
That's good insight, Elizabeth. Thank you for that. And let's turn to Elizabeth's first point, if you don't mind taking that, Delegate Yost.
Yeah, you know, this is something that I've talked about. I actually wrote an editorial in the Roanoke Times about it a couple months ago. You know, the changes that were proposed and have went into effect, you know, relating to mental health supports are huge. You know, they do have, I think, some consequences. And Elizabeth is absolutely right. Mental health supports, PAC teams, these types of preventive care, you know, evidence-based practices provide a huge service to individuals and their family members, but also to the community, because if they're getting the preventive care medicine that these individuals are providing, they're not cycling out of emergency rooms, they're not being hospitalized, and they're not going to jail. These are what I consider, or what I like to call, upstream investments. They might cost a little bit more money up front, but the payoff down the road is probably 3 times as much.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the stigma of mental health that keeps people from even getting a diagnosis in the first place. There are many people with diagnosable mental illnesses who aren't getting help. Being told you're bipolar is a relief to some people, but a stigma to others. So let's discuss the outreach that's going to get people help some counseling, some medications and all of that in the first place who are way under the radar?
Well, sure. I'll make a quick comment on that and then let Mira and Bonnie chime in. Trying to destigmatize, the mental health population is probably, in addition to getting more money for services, is probably one of the best things we can do. That's what I spend a lot of my time doing, is trying to, educate folks on what having a mental health issue is and is not. The number one thing that I hear when I'm out and about, either at community events or even just going grocery shopping, is individuals will come up to me and say, I really appreciate what you're doing on the mental health side because I have a brother or a sister or an aunt or uncle or a close friend who has a mental health problem. And the governor's absolutely right. It touches everybody. Like Bonnie said, 1 in 4.
And people often hear, they may have someone tell them, oh, Bonnie, you have a mental illness. And we have so much stigma against mental illness. We see that in our media. Some of our favorite TV shows that we watch, the bad guy is always a psychotic person or a person with schizophrenia or a person with bipolar disorder, and that's causing their badness. And we tend to start separating. We really have an us versus them attitude about people with mental illness when we look at the state. But us versus them is the wrong way to look at it, because we are 1 in 4. People like myself who have diagnoses or one diagnosis are afraid to disclose it. It impacts your ability to get a job. It impacts how your family interacts with you and your friends interact with you just when they know your diagnosis. It impacts It impacts your family's willingness to talk about you in public, because there is some perceived embarrassment or shame that comes with it sometimes. So we need more people speaking out and saying, oh, my mother, my brother, my sister, I am one of those people who may have been diagnosed with a mental illness, but look, I'm still a person. Maylil, you talked about how we're moving away from the term consumer. We often talked about mental health consumers, and I introduced myself as a person with mental health experience. And we're moving away from that word consumer and calling myself a person, person first. We talk about person first language. Let's look at the individual. Let's look at the individual when we're treating them. What does that person most need? But also just in stigma, stop considering us them. Stop considering people with mental illnesses one of them, but we're all part of us. We're all people.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org, and find out about upcoming topics and comment on past ones on Facebook. Just search for Virginia Conversations and like us. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Today, we're talking about ways to improve Virginia's mental health care system. Our guests are Mira Signer, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Virginia, and Delegate Joseph Yost, who has introduced legislation to help improve mental health care in the state. He's also a member of the Governor's Task Force on Improving Mental Health Services and Crisis Response. And, Delegate, we will get back to you around some of the specific bills being introduced into the General Assembly. And I'd like to turn to Bonnie Naber of VOCAL. Again, tell us what VOCAL stands for.
VOCAL is an acronym that stands for Virginia Organization of Consumers Asserting Leadership.
For their quiz, they have a mental health quiz, and one of the top questions is this one. So if you're listening, certainly if you're driving, do not pull out a pen. But here's the question. It's a myth or fact kind of question around mental health. On average, people living with mental illness are A, more likely to be violent than the general population, or B, about the same likelihood to be violent as the general population. A or B? Gave that a moment to consider it? Great. The answer is B. Studies continue to show that people with mental health and substance use conditions are no more violent than the general population. Now, there are going to be people who think, oh, I'm looking at Sandy Hook, I'm looking at Virginia Tech, and more recently the stabbing of Cree Deeds, and that doesn't fit. How can that be?
Well, in general, what we know is that it's extremely difficult to predict the incidence or the likelihood of a person with or without mental illness to be violent. And we do know that in general, as the quiz said, that people with mental illness are just as, no more likely to be violent as somebody, who's in the general public. And in fact, they're often victims of violence. And further, that violence is also directed towards oneself in terms of self-harm or suicidal behavior and that sort of thing, rather than perpetrated on other people. That being said, we do know from research that there are some indicators that put somebody at a greater risk of violence, such as being a young adult, being male, not being able to access treatment or failing to stay in treatment that has been deemed necessary, substance use, having some sort of troubling incident or troubling crisis that has evolved. So there are some risk factors, but in general and in terms of the previous discussion about stigma, we feel it's important to kind of try to dispel the myth that people with mental illness are violent.
I think there's two additional risk factors that we need to consider also, particularly when we add them together, young men who perhaps have felt jilted or ostracized recently. Perhaps they turned in a paper at school and they got a grade they didn't think they deserved, or they asked someone out in a romantic situation and they got jilted. That often also increases their risk for violence in the immediate. And something we don't talk about much is that some of the very medications that we use to treat people for mental health conditions can, especially in the beginning of the medication's use, increase their potential for irritability, for violent-type behaviors, for self-harm, and for suicide. And I think that came out particularly after the shooting at the Navy Yard, which is one we didn't mention, that in the 2 weeks prior to the incident in the Navy Yard, the individual had seen two separate doctors who both prescribed a new medication, and it didn't appear that there was any follow-up on either one of them on that medication.
To that point, Bonnie, I want to read from a letter that was written by a citizen of Milford, Connecticut. Jeffrey Dudley wrote this letter to the General Assembly, an open letter, and addresses that. Briefly, he says, "The madness of Sandy Hook, Columbine, Virginia Tech, and others is an issue unto itself. These events have been perpetrated by young men being treated for mental illness. It has been widely reported that these individuals were taking SSRIs, SNIs, or the like. The real problem here is that no one really knows if a patient will become suicidal or manic until these medications are prescribed. There's no standard for monitoring their use. These drugs have the capacity to cause a patient to become dissociative and result in a loss of contact with reality."
So I certainly don't want to demonize the medication or the treatments. There needs to be more patient involvement in the choice, I believe. But I think by only focusing on mental illness and people's diagnoses and not focusing on all those other variables, a person's age, their gender, what's going on in their life, if they're on new medications or not, we're really missing the point. And we're going to keep trying to plug this hole, and we're not plugging it.
Now turning to the General Assembly, Delegate Yost, you've introduced, to my knowledge, three bills relating to mental health care reform. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. We introduced actually our first three bills for the 2014 session, dealt with mental health law reform, and came about as some of the recommendations that Governor McDonnell and Secretary Bill Hazel had made as a result of Cree Deeds and his son on November 19th. But then also one of them was one that I had carried in the 2013 session that has been a recommendation for years upon years.
And can you give us a thumbnail on each of those?
Yeah, the first bill deals with emergency custody orders, or as they're called, more commonly called ECOs. This is where an individual is held basically under detention while community services personnel screen them for various reasons to see if they're eligible for hospitalization. Currently in the Commonwealth, emergency custody orders will last for 4 hours. Then there's an option to apply for an additional two-hour extension, so you can only be held up to 6 hours under emergency custody order. House Bill 241 would add for the option of applying for another 2 hours, so that the total time would then be 8 hours. House Bill 242 deals with emergency custody orders as well. Basically, it would allow that before, if a TDO can go ahead and be issued, or a TDO is a temporary detention order, it can be issued without a hospital facility actually have been found during the bed search process yet. But there is a section in there that would say, you know, a good faith effort will be continue to be made for the bed to be found in a timely fashion. And then the third one that we carried over from last year dealt with the temporary detention order process and bumps that up from 48 hours to 72 hours in the Commonwealth. Right now, across the country, Virginia actually has the shortest temporary detention process at 48 hours, us and two other states. There's three states that have 30 days, and the average is anywhere between 7 and 10 days.
These are not dissimilar from the emergency custody order bill that Creed Eads wants to see enacted.
They're not too dissimilar. He's asking for a little bit more time on some of these issues. And so, yeah, they're all sort of in the same, I guess you could say, category of what's trying to be done.
Okay. Mira Signer.
Sure. I guess just a couple of comments. Some of these issues have been discussed and proposed and examined for many years, and for various reasons they haven't gone forth, or you know, just have stalled. And they're important. You know, they're important aspects to our mental health law, mental health system, and you know, it's obviously time to take another look at them, explore what the impacts are. You know, there certainly is a general feeling among those who are involved in this part of the mental health process that the time period is inadequate, it's too short, you know, there's no way to do a proper assessment, you know, much less find a bed. And then, you know, you also look at that we are one of the shortest TDO lengths in all of the country. And, you know, generally you want to be not at either end of the extreme. You know, you want to be kind of running in the middle of the pack on some of these types of measures. So again, it'll be interesting to kind of get a closer look at some of these measures, and you know, possibly have some changes made that, in keeping with additional resources, will have an impact. And you know, I guess just in closing, our feeling is that tweaking the law is sometimes necessary. It can help to address shortfalls and gaps and, you know, kind of shortcomings within the way that the process works, but that they really shouldn't be done in a vacuum. You know, you've got to have the services to back it up, the resources, the capacity. You know, it really goes hand in hand in order to truly make a difference.
And Delegate Yost, what's your prognosis for 2014? Are the tides changing?
You know, I definitely think that they are. There's a lot of conversation out there, and I know talking to the governor-elect and some of his incoming members of the administration, there's definitely a push and an interest over the next, you know, 4 years to work on our mental health system. I think if you talk to a lot of folks, you know, there's hasn't been a whole lot done necessarily because of other things that have going on in terms of our Department of Justice settlement with our training centers in Virginia and everything else. But I do think there will be a push. And, you know, I will say before I have to get off and run over to the Capitol, you know, Mayor is absolutely right. You know, these three bills that I proposed are not silver bullet cures. All we're asking for is a little bit more time. But our best things that we can do are further investments in services.
Delegate Joseph Yost from the 12th House District, who is introducing three measures for mental health care reform in the state. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And now we turn to Rachel, a caller from Blacksburg. Good morning, Rachel.
I work for a private company in the mental health field and community, and I was just calling to make people aware of the fact that within the medical field itself, many medical professionals are not aware of how to use mental health supports more effectively to save the community more money in terms of chronic illness. When people are depressed, people do not take care of their weight. People do not take care of the wounds on their body, and so they cost the community a lot more money in terms of then becoming, you know, chronic users of or more intensive users of the medical system as well as the emergency department. So I think medical people need to use mental health services more when people are depressed.
And Rachel, you're a mental health care provider. What do you do?
I'm an in-home mental health support provider, but as of 12-1, we're called Mental Health Skill Builders. So I help people put into place the directions that are given to them by their psychiatrists, by their therapists, by their doctors, and help them more efficiently and more effectively care for themselves personally as well as interact in the community more effectively.
Great. Thank you so much for your comment this morning.
Thanks so much.
It's interesting that Rachel's not the only one who's chimed in this morning as an in-care provider. And this is the first as a layperson that I've heard of this form of service.
Right. There are a number of services, not only for adults, but also for children and adolescents and youth that are being provided in a community-based setting, but more specifically, actually in one's home and the environment where they live with parents or with family. And that sort of thing. You have PACT, which stands for Programs of Assertive Community Treatment, which is almost a hospital without walls type program. It is an evidence-based, research-based program with excellent outcomes in terms of keeping adults safe and stable in their homes. And then you've got what some of the callers have referred to as mental health skill building, which is a specific service provided under the various array of services provided under Medicaid that, again, is an in-home based service, which is less – it's sort of a step-down or less intensive service than hospital. And then there's also a service called Intensive In-Home that is specifically for children and adolescents that, again, is provided in the home and in the community.
Rachel talks about the physical ailments tied to people living with mental illness, and it goes to one of your quiz questions on the Vocal website. Bonnie, it says, on average, compared to the general population, consumers with a serious mental illness will A, live about 5 years less, B, live about 10 years less, or C, live about 25 years less.
So the most recent statistic is that mental health consumers or people who are in mental health treatment is actually the population. The answer is C. We are dying 25 years younger from modifiable health risks. I think people jump to the conclusion that we're dying 25 years younger from suicide, and that's not the case. Modifiable health risks such as heart disease, metabolic disorder, similar diseases to that. And that statistic has gone up from a deficit of 8 years, not too terribly long ago, to now 25 years less. And so we are moving in the wrong direction and looking at individuals' whole health.
Yeah, and that seems like a valid point that Rachel brings out, the fact that there is an impact now on the healthcare system, not just mental health.
That's correct.
So it's a pervasive issue that a lot of people may not be aware of. We're talking about the jail system, the medical healthcare system, as well as the mental healthcare system.
I think that there's one additional system, and I use the word system in quotes, to also be aware of, and a lot of people aren't aware of. It's the things that are happening in the community, that there are many programs in the community that are not part of the system, that programs that are led by people with mental health lived experience who are receiving some state funds or block grant funds for the mental health block grant, who are providing services in the community to help people start identifying those things that are getting in their way and some wellness tools that they can use and some health tools that they can take care of themselves. And so you can receive help within the system itself or things that are happening in the community from people who have been down that journey and what has worked for them and how can you get around what's getting in the way.
Right. And just to kind of piggyback on that a little bit, there are many systems. It is extremely complex. You know, you're dealing with the juvenile justice system for when it comes to kids, the jail and prison system for adults, homelessness, and housing type systems, so on and so forth. So it is extremely complex, and there are a number of initiatives and programs and things that are going on, outside of the official kind of traditional mental health system. And one of those is something that our organization does quite a lot of, which is educating families about mental illnesses, what they are, how to be supportive, what is not necessarily supportive, although you might think it is supportive, how to get help, how to navigate a very complex system. And we know from research that people with mental illness tend to fare a little bit better if their families are properly educated, informed, and also, as Bonnie's been talking about, if the person, him or herself, who has a mental health issue is also aware and educated about their own illness and has the tools and ability to do some of that self-management.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. I want to thank our guests, Mira Signer, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Virginia, and Delegate Joseph Yost from the 12th House District, as well as Bonnie Naber, Executive Director of the Virginia Organization of Consumers Asserting Leadership. It's great to have all of you on the program, and thank you to those of you who have called in today. Thanks for listening. On the next edition of Virginia Conversations, how one Virginia Tech instructor pulled off teaching his classes from halfway around the world on the open seas. That's next time on Virginia Conversations. Until then, I'm May Lily Lee, wishing you a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.